Welcome to Mandates and Megaphones, hosted by Jeremy Maggs. Unpacking the politics, promises, and power plays behind the G20 summit.
Hello and welcome to Mandates and Megaphones here on MoneyWeb in association with Standard Bank. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Now, South Africa steps onto the world stage this year as G20 host with energy security, climate transition and industrial opportunity firmly under the global spotlight. At the heart of this moment sits a critical question. How does Africa power growth without deepening energy poverty or falling behind in a fast-changing green economy? Now, government has framed its G20 legacy program around tackling energy inefficiency, boosting investment into clean technology, and boosting the continent not just as a climate-vulnerable region, but as a future green industrial powerhouse. That includes advancing renewable energy manufacturing, unlocking clean power finance, and ensuring nuclear, gas and renewables policy works for both growth and the environment. Well, I'm joined now by the Deputy Minister of Energy and Electricity, Samantha Graham-Marais. Deputy Minister, a very warm welcome. And let's start with the big picture. South Africa says this G20 presidency will put energy security and energy justice at the center of the global debate. But what does that actually mean in practice for citizens and businesses across the continent?
Yeah, Jeremy, you know, we, as the only African country on the G20, we really felt that this was an opportunity for us to highlight not just what we're doing in South Africa and what our needs are, but also to really shine a spotlight on Africa and how far behind the energy revolution Africa is. I'm sure people are sick and tired of hearing it, but we're going to repeat it until it's no longer a statistic. 600 million people in Africa do not have access to electricity. And over a billion people in Africa do not have access to clean cooking. So for us, this was really going to be one of our number one priorities. It's not only ensuring that there is electricity availability, but also that as we do that, we increase the energy security of both South Africa and the continent. So we made our third priority as the Energy Transitions Working Group a very much Africa-focused. It spoke to how we're going to increase the interconnectivity of the continent, how we're going to work with the rest of Africa. It highlighted the Mission 300 program, which aims to provide energy access to 300 million Africans by 2030. We had clean cooking as one of our priority outcomes. And then on the sidelines of the G20 at the Energy Transitions Working Group 4 at the ministerial, we also signed an MOU to launch the Energy Efficiency Facility for Africa, which will be properly launched in Addis Ababa in December. But essentially, this is a facility to raise money to make sure that we're providing energy efficiency throughout Africa. Because it doesn't help that we increase Africa's connectivity and then we don't give them energy efficiency, which is what we call the first fuel. So most of the priority outcomes that we had a strong focus on energy security, which obviously coming out of load shedding like we have is a number one priority for us. And then also accessibility and the interconnectivity of the African continent.
Deputy Minister, energy justice, I think you'll agree with me, can sound like a very vague term. Are you able to put a little bit more flesh on the bones there? What do you believe fair transition actually means for a household?
Well, you know, we talk a lot about the transition, but you know, the transition has the ability to leave people behind. If we're not in conversation with people, we're not addressing their direct needs. We're not making sure that people can afford energy. You know, it doesn't help that we go and roll out energy to everybody, and then people have no means to pay for it. So energy justice speaks to things like affordability. It speaks to accessibility. It speaks to availability, and then to the other things that come with energy, like, as I said, clean cooking. You know, over 500,000 women and small children die every year on the African continent from respiratory conditions that are caused by unclean cooking. So clean cooking, luckily, was the one outcome that we did manage to get absolute consensus on as one of our priority outcomes. And that's obviously something we're going to drive very strongly in South Africa and across Africa. So in South Africa, the clean cooking focus is how do we take people off electricity into other methodologies? Because We have a 94% penetration rate in South Africa, but affordability has become an issue. And for the rest of Africa, it's how do we find other energy and potentially electricity for them to be able to cook. So it's quite a juxtaposition between Africa, the whole of Africa and South Africa. But energy justice is about finding energy sources and energy availability that suits the needs of the people and ensuring that if the energy is available, that they can afford to have it. It doesn't help to, you know, entrench energy poverty. People can see power lines, but they've got no power in their homes.
Once you've identified a priority outcome, Deputy Minister, as you've put it, how then do you navigate its rapid passage towards some sort of consensus, which is then actionable?
With the G20, with our working group, unfortunately, we had 7 priority outcomes that we had hoped to achieve. We couldn't get consensus on any of them, particularly because a lot of what we were talking about was the just energy transition. And we understand that America, under the new presidency, have a huge issue around climate change, around transitioning, around green energy, because it spoke to this energy transition, renewables, a move away from coal and gas. And obviously that didn't speak to the American agenda. So we focused on what we could get consensus on, and that ultimately was only on clean cooking, and the Americans were very, very supportive of that outcome. So our decision ultimately would be then that although we couldn't get consensus on all the objectives we had set for ourselves, it didn't mean that that put a halt to the programs that we were trying to achieve. So we've already launched a clean cooking legacy project in Mpumalanga, which we will continue to roll out. We're already having the conversations with the rest of Africa, particularly the region, around interconnectors and how we can bring Africa's energy to everybody. We're already part of the Mission 300 program. We've now rolled out our IRP, so we're making sure that we're meeting our own energy objectives in South Africa. So, you know, consensus or not, it was an opportunity for us to highlight what we needed. It was an opportunity for us to engage. And I keep saying to people, you know, this year, the networking we've been able to do through G20, we would never have been able to do in 5 years of a term because of the, you know, the number of people that we got to meet in one place regularly. So irrespective of the outcomes of the G20, the fact that we've been able to network to the extent we have, highlight our issues, highlight Africa's issues, we've completely gained out of this G20, and I think it's been exceptionally good for us as a country. Mm.
I don't want to diminish the importance of what you've achieved so far, particularly when it comes to clean cooking, but not having broader consensus on the so-called big ticket items, surely that puts the entire process of fair and just transition on the back foot.
Not really. You know, our international partners who are partnering with us on the just energy transition, you know, America withdrew their funding for it right at the beginning of the year when they made this decision that they were no longer sort of looking at climate change and just energy transitions, etc. But Europe has stepped into the breach. So they've added to the money that they've already given us in terms of our just energy transition. We're having fantastic conversations with, you know, countries like Korea and Japan as to how they can support our outcomes. We're partnering with countries in Africa. And Europe, as I say, continues to be our biggest supporter in terms of the just energy transition. None of their programs have changed. If anything, they're upping the ante on what we're doing because they see what we're doing as a lesson for the rest of the world. You know, for so long, 98% of the climate change funding that would go to this just energy transition has not come to Africa. So only 2 to 3% of what's available has come here. What we've managed to do now is have the conversations that will see some of that money being channeled now. So we've increased our visibility as a continent. We've had an opportunity to demonstrate that we're not just a continent that's looking for handouts, but that we're a continent that brings a lot to the table. So we're looking for partnerships as opposed to being sort of seen as this begging bowl. And this G20 has allowed us to have those conversations. We've had conversations on critical minerals as an example. We provide 40% of the world's resources around the just energy transition. We can no longer just be beneficiaries. We have to be part of the conversation. And this is what G20 has given us.
Providing you leverage that position quickly, otherwise you're going to lose momentum.
Absolutely. You know, the funding that we've got for the just energy transition has got a shelf life. We've battled to spend that money for a whole host of reasons. So that conversation has been highlighted, and it's a conversation that we're taking very seriously. You know, it's also a few years into this energy transition. It's also given us an opportunity that when we crafted this conversation, our needs were very different. We were in the middle of an energy crisis. We weren't entirely sure what we needed. We were being pressured by the Global North to adhere to a number of rules and priorities. And I think what's happened is that as we've come out of this energy crisis, we've stabilized our own energy system. We're now in a position to review the priorities that were set for the just energy transition and make them a South African just energy transition and not a European one. So we're going to be reviewing the priorities of the just energy transition to make sure that they align with what we're trying to achieve, particularly in light of the IRP and the other objectives we've set as a ministry. And then we'll have a look at how we start spending that money, because we definitely haven't accessed nearly enough of the money that's available to us to have catalytic projects that are genuinely making a difference.
You talk about having secured 2-3% of the funding. If I've read this correctly, Africa needs something in the region of $100 billion a year for energy transition. Do you realistically expect to make progress in this particular hunt for capital, or are we constantly falling behind the curve?
It always boils down to money, obviously, you know, and trying to access money. But you know, the World Bank and African Development Bank have really come to the party in terms of the Mission 300. So that is a huge program of which we are part. So they will do a lot of that capital funding. So, you know, people talk a lot about the sort of risk profile of Africa. Our risk profile isn't as bad as people like to make out. Yes, we have a lot of political instability, but in terms of the actual spend and the way that money is utilized in Africa, you know, people like to think that we're corrupt. We're not that bad. And there is definitely an appetite for this development. And we're seeing as well that countries that are really industrialized, your Global North, they are finding now that they've got energy security problems as well, which means that they're going to be more and more reliant on us for them to meet their targets. So, for example, the targets they've set for, you know, ESAF, which is your aviation fuel, they have a certain target they have to meet. They can't meet it without the Global South contributing to those targets. So there is a lot of money available. Our problem has been accessing it, creating bankable projects that people can invest in, because that is very difficult. And our problem is obviously that we can't take on more debt as a country, because obviously our debt is far too high. So it's about finding where we can have grant funding, or, you know, concessional loans that can unlock additional funding that can build on that.
Let me extend that a little bit, Deputy Minister. I'd also suggest that foreign funding always comes with conditions. Critical that you protect energy sovereignty while you're accessing global capital. In other words, you can't give away too much, can you?
No, without question. You know, at the end of the day, we can't be selling our souls for monies. We're happy to, you know, agree to certain conditions. For example, you know, some of the countries that give money say, right, that requires that perhaps you need to use some of our companies that are based in South Africa for some of the projects. Happy to do that, because obviously they're creating jobs in South Africa, they're invested in our economy, and we're more than happy to support those. So those kind of concessional loans, we're more than happy to agree to. But we cannot continue to commit to loans that are going to undermine our ability to pay them off. So we have to be very careful how we use money that's given to us. And that's been the problem with the JET funding. A lot of that is loan funding. It's not grant funding. So we do need more grant funding. But we also need to start as a country and a continent to find ways to generate our own capital through the projects we're doing. So it doesn't help to be continually borrowing money to build projects. And then that's not leveraging an ability for us to then generate our own capital and create our own funding and our own projects.
Deputy Minister, I want to come back to jobs. I also want to talk about the nuclear option, which is also on the table. But maybe just give me a sense, when you're having these conversations, how do you balance the needs between what South Africa needs and those of the rest of the continent? Often there is conflict and different priorities.
Look, at the end of the day, when we're having those conversations, South Africa has to be our priority. South Africa's stable. We're the most industrialized nation on the continent, but we also have the highest unemployment rate in the world. So when we're having conversations with anybody, there are two priorities from the Department of Electricity and Energy, or our ministry. Those two priorities are, number one, energy security. So any conversation we have having has to speak to the energy security of this country. The second priority for us is jobs. We are not going to have conversations that are going to result in more job losses. And if anything, any conversation we have has to be around how do we create more jobs, how do we build skills, and how do we make sure that we're employing more and more of our own people. In addition, as we look at things like the South African Renewable Energy Master Plan, which is an industrialization program, if we can create industrial hubs around renewable energy in South Africa, we can then feed into Africa as opposed to us using other countries that are outside the African continent. So we're looking at how we can develop the South African economy within the energy space to become, you know, Africa for Africans, as opposed to being dumped with the cheaper options that come from around the world.
You speak about reindustrialization then through energy. Have you identified which manufacturing opportunities are most realistic for South Africa in the next couple of years that will create that jobs pipeline that you have already referred to?
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, we have been very, very realistic in this conversation. We can't compete with the likes of China on solar panels and wind turbines. No. There's just no ways. They're already far ahead of us. We can't do it cheaper. But localization needs to become not just a buzzword, but actually a priority for us. We have identified through the support of, say, the Manufacturing Circle, who have been unbelievably supportive in this process, they have identified 4,000 components in the renewable energy value chain currently that we can manufacture competitively in South Africa using our own raw materials, using the skills we have. So already we've done that identification. We're now embarking on a cost-benefit analysis study that we're going to be doing on the entire SARAM program to see also, you know, where are our real competitive advantages so that we can start promoting that. Human resources is a huge value proposition for us. So one of the things that SARAM initially didn't look at was the service industry around the renewable energy value chain. So that's another area that we're now starting to look at quite seriously. How do we service gearboxes in South Africa? I mean, they're currently being sent out of the country to be serviced and refurbished. We can do that here. How do we create small, medium, micro enterprises around existing sites, washing solar panels, you know, keeping the weeds away, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not just looking at industry per se, but also a service industry that we can build around that. So we are busy with the cost benefit analysis that's going into that. We're looking at obviously the skills element of it. It's a very strong part of the Renewable Energy Master Plan. And then, as I say, we've now identified these components. The question is, how do we now make those into viable, you know, industrial propositions?
Difficult, of course, to put an exact number on jobs that would be created, though.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, the initial statement with regard to SARAM was 25,000 jobs. That doesn't sound like a lot, but that's just within the SARAM sort of environment. But, you know, with the IRP coming out now and its big focus on the renewable energy value chain, that's going to create the policy certainty that everybody's been waiting for. It's going to create the pipeline of projects that everybody needed in order for them to start investing. And the more we can get that, obviously it starts to create this economy of scale that ultimately can then create these huge opportunities for us.
Deputy Minister, let's talk a little bit about energy mix. As you've been talking to me about renewables are central, but obviously baseload matters. Where do nuclear and gas fit into the long-term strategy?
In terms of the energy mix that we're looking at, one of the big components is definitely going to be storage. So battery storage, pump storage, those are going to become crucial as we increase the renewable energy mix in our sort of energy ecosystem. Gas, at this stage, the major focus on gas is to convert, obviously, our peaking plants, so Gariqua and Ankerlich, to potentially become gas systems, because it's going to be a lot cheaper than running them on diesel. So that'll be the immediate focus of the gas component is on these combined cycle gas turbines. But ultimately, we're also going to need to have a good source of gas in this country, because we don't have our own gas. And the gas we're getting from Mozambique, we've got a gas cliff that we're facing into 2028. So we need to find new sources of gas, particularly to feed to our industrial gas users. gas is also a component that we can look at for gas to power. So we have companies like Sasol, like external companies that are starting to look at gas to power as an option. And ultimately, we could be converting some of our coal-fired power stations into gas-fired power stations. So gas, we see it very much as a transition fuel that takes us from the coal environment into a new baseload through, say, storage and nuclear. Obviously, people keep saying, you know, why nuclear? It's a long-term strategy. But the point is, if we don't start planning for nuclear now, then it becomes an even longer-term strategy. We're looking at a sort of 10 to 15-year process if we start now. So we need to start now. We've already got an IEA on the Daniefontein site for about 4,500 megawatts, although the application is for 2,500 megawatts of nuclear. And we really do see nuclear as a fundamental component of building baseload power, which is very stable, it's clean. Once you've done your capital bills, which is, as we all know, very expensive, it's one of the cheapest forms of electricity that you can get. If you look at the power we're getting from Cuburg, it's really the cheapest power on the grid. So nuclear is very much part of our long-term strategy. Also, as part of the G20, we commissioned a report from the International Atomic Energy Agency to look at how we can move from coal to nuclear. The conversation around SMRs is really, really big. These are now coming into commercial operation in various countries. So small modular reactors are definitely an option that we're looking at for converting existing coal-fired power stations into potentially nuclear-fired power stations. And also, as I'm sure many people don't know, we were the leading country in the world when it came to small modular reactors in terms of the development we did on what was called the pebble bed modular reactor. That was placed into care and maintenance a number of years ago as we sort of scaled down on our nuclear interests in this country. But we are looking at taking the PBMR out of care and maintenance to review the IP, you know, the intellectual property that was utilized in that, and then to review that against existing IP that exists around SMRs, and then to make a determination as to what technologies we will be looking at using small modular reactors going forward. The nice thing about those, about SMRs, is that they're modularized. So as you need to up your power requirements, you then can bring in additional modules. The University of Pretoria with certain partners is also looking at micro power reactors. So these little reactors that are about 12 megawatts that can be used to power water reticulation systems, that can be used in informal settlements ultimately. So there's a lot of development and scope around the nuclear build, and that's obviously going to be a focus, but not a primary focus. It's going to be part of our broader, you know, variety of energy that we're going to be reviewing going forward.
Let me ask you one last question, and it's around accountability, I guess. What's the one KPI that the public should use then to judge success on energy by the end of this country's G20 presidency?
It's difficult to say in terms of that. I mean, look, at the end of the day, I keep saying to people, you know, people ask me, you know, what's your big success? I'll say, well, load shedding. So ultimately, we've already proven that we have plans that are workable. You know, we have met a number of the objectives we already set for ourselves. You know, our department was only established on the 1st of April this year. So we came in as part of an existing department that hadn't really done that well in terms of energy, that had a different focus. So already as a department, we have hosted a very successful energy transition working group. We have launched our transmission program, our independent transmission program. We have managed to get Sarum through and launched. Sarum has been 6 years in the making. It was 3 years that program sat on our desk. We've gotten Sarum out. We have managed to get our IRP out eventually. And it's an IRP that most people can kind of live with. I mean, you know, you never make everybody happy. We have broader goals that we have set for the department. And we honestly feel that, you know, we've launched a coalition for industrialization of green hubs. So we're looking at setting up green energy hubs around the country that are industrial zones. We've launched the energy efficiency program for Africa. So I do believe that we have already demonstrated a huge amount of work in this year, and that has laid the platform for the rest of the term of office that we will serve. And I honestly believe that South Africans are going to see innovation, growth, and development emanating from our department going forward.
Samantha Graham-Murray, Deputy Minister, Electricity and Energy, thank you very much for joining me on this edition of Mandates and Megaphones here on MoneyWeb.
Thank you for listening to Mandates and Megaphones. You can find more episodes on moneyweb.co.za.